This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Pablo Johnson has a table. I've sat at it. It's big and made of wood, and to the naked eye, it may not seem very special, but this table belonged to his grandmother. And on it, she fed her 8 kids, plus whoever was around, every night. And so, for the last 15 or so years he's had that table with him in New Orleans, he's used it to feed whoever's around every Monday. Red beans and rice, cornbread, whiskey for dessert. And here's the thing. It's never been the same group twice. It's old friends, friends of friends, friends he's just meeting as they shake on some hot sauce, strangers passing through town, but for well over a decade, that table has been a landing pad for new New Orleanians, a political salon, an emotional anchor, a place of new and very old friendships. And as we were thinking about a show of stories about feeding family, I kept thinking back to Pablo's table and how he's made a new family at it every week. Pablo, so great to have you here.
Hey, Francis.
So let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
How did you get to thinking, you know what, I'm going to start feeding random people at my house every week?
It didn't start off quite as random. Before I lived in New Orleans, I lived in Austin for about 10 years. And my entertaining style in Austin was doing whole day parties that were big gumbo and red beans parties that eventually 150 or 200 people would come over the course of a Sunday. When I went to New Orleans, I had this my grandmother's table, and I decided to switch to weekly because one of the longstanding food traditions of New Orleans is red beans on Monday night. And so instead of 150 people once every 3 months, it just became 10 to 12 once a week. And that just changed the rhythm of the way that I cooked, and that by definition changed the menu that I served. And it just basically adapted to something that was easier and lower maintenance to pull off on a Monday. And people aren't often doing things on Monday nights, so it tends to be free and it tends to be a good break during the early work week and something to look forward to. And that's kind of where it came from. It's like once that ritual, once that rhythm was established, you have 10, 12 seats to fill every week. And it started off with a smaller group of friends, and then it became bigger. And then everybody just kind of rotated in and out until it had a kind of large format, kismet-driven, you know, weekly event that everybody looked forward to.
Yeah. Well, I love that it's the same thing, not just like in terms of ritual, but it's if you have this thing that you're doing every single week on the same day, it's not entertaining. It's not a dinner party. It's not, oh, how am I going to impress people? What am I going to do? You know, you're just feeding people, and it's a constant. And that feels to me like that's as much about the idea of ritual and community and family as it is, hey, let me cook for you this awesome thing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's important about that table is that it wasn't the dining table at my grandmother's house. It was the kitchen table. That was where all the grandkids went. The fancy dining room table didn't get used every day, but this one did. So this is where all the power was. And during big holiday meals, as kids, you kind of wanted to be invited to the fancy dining room table. But then once you got there, you almost always wanted to come back to the kitchen table because that felt more like home. And you didn't have to wear special clothes to sit at the kitchen table. And that's, again, that's a tradition that I carry forward. It's like it's when people use words to describe the gathering as it's a salon or it's a dinner party, I almost always correct them because it's like it really is just people getting together and talking. It's really just it's supper. It's not a dinner party. There have been attempts at different times for people to do things like, well, we should bring a salad. Can I bring a salad? And I try to gently discourage that. Part of it is I don't have 12 salad plates. And once you start adding different components to it, things get really complicated very quickly. And also that's about, you know, it's twice as many things I have to clean up, and I'm kind of cleanup averse. but it is literally just serve yourself I put a roll of paper towels on the table for linens. I put the spoons in the middle. Everybody gets their own drink, and it's self-serve. If you want more, just get up and get it. It's that informality that I think helps people be a lot more comfortable and concentrate on just whatever random conversation is going to happen. Sometimes it's full table. Sometimes it's, you know, let's say you have 12 people at the table. Sometimes it's all one big conversation, and it's great. And it's just large enough and just small enough. It's still human scale, but it still feels like a bigger table than people will generally sit at in the course of their normal life. And for me, it's like it's an easy thing. I mean, it's once you build up those muscles, it's nothing to do it. One of the great joys for me is I get to connect with a wide variety of people, a lot of them from in town, who, you know, you may happen across after not seeing them for a few months. And you don't have to say, you know, we should get together sometime. You can say, what are you doing this Monday, next Monday, or the following? It also keeps me honest in keeping my house relatively clean. it's such a great chance to learn, you know, from people you know or people you don't. I've made a lot of really good friends who were friends of friends, or they came as guests. Like, hey, I got a friend coming in from out of town. Is there room? And there's usually room. There's very few times when there's not. Because one of the South Louisiana rules is that if too many people show up for the food that you have, you can always make more rice. You know, the rule is make more rice and make family eat last. But that's generally not a problem. If it's supposed to happen, you can find a way to make it happen. Yeah, that's just basic hosting. And again, that goes back to it being a very simple meal. Yeah. And not having a lot of expectations. You know, it's that dish done really well, but it is just, it's supper. So yeah. don't try to fancy it up. Just come with a bottle of wine, come with a six-pack of beer, come with some fizzy water, and we'll just eat and we'll drink. Yeah. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah. It's supper. It's simple. It's constant. And it's an amazing way to make sure you really live among your people. Thanks so much for talking with us, Pablo.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
Pablo Johnson is a photographer and writer in New Orleans and ringleader of the traveling Red Beans Roadshow. You can find information on how to get tickets for that, as well as his recipe for red beans and rice, at splendidtable.org. One of the truisms of the restaurant business is that the people you work with become your family. Now, depending on the people, it could be one big happy family or, like, you know, a dysfunctional cult. But if you find yourself night after night working when most other people are playing, and you all leave work together charged on adrenaline when everyone else is asleep, you can see why these people become your people. And then there are wine people. Among sommeliers, there's a particular bond. You know, a deep knowledge of wine, yeah, but also that no one else really quite understands why you care so much about wine, except your sommelier family. Bianca Bosker tells us a story of how she fell into this family.
Perfume was the first to go, but I'd been expecting that. Scented detergent followed, then dryer sheets. I wasn't sorry to give up raw onions or hot sauce. I went through a dark phase when I cut out coffee. But by that point, I was used to being a little slow in the morning. Daytime sobriety was ancient history, along with all hot liquids, the enamel in my teeth, and my Advil supply. All this was part of the routine I cobbled together at the advice of more than 24 sommeliers, who, during the span of more than a year, became my mentors, tormentors, drill sergeants, bosses, and friends. I'd come to them a wine ignoramus, which had never bothered me until I discovered this world of fanatical cork dorks. These people live for taste. They train their senses the way Olympians train their bodies. They divorce spouses to spend more time studying bottles, and they detect stories where the rest of us pick up merely smells. I was living at the opposite extreme. As the tech editor for an online website, I'd spent 5 years at screens immersed in a world that couldn't be touched, tasted, or smelled. It was a life of sensory deprivation, not sensory cultivation. And as I learned more about this elite subculture of somms, I got fixated. What was I missing? I came to them wanting to know what life was like at the extremes of taste. Then it became a question of whether I could get there too, if any one of us could get there, and what would change if we did. Despite my loved ones' objections, I quit my steady job and got hired as a cellar rat, the lowest of the low in the wine world. From there, I set out to train as a sommelier. As a journalist, I'd maintained more or less the same routine for half a decade. Wake up, take the subway to 8th Street, and arrive at the office by 9:30 a.m. in time for our editorial meeting. Under my new regime as an official member of New York's Wine Army, I began visiting free tastings hosted by wine distributors, those middlemen who sell to stores and restaurants. Most days, I was nursing my first glass of wine around the same hour I'd usually be running through the morning's headlines. I was drunk by noon, hungover by 2 p.m., and around 4 in the afternoon, deeply regretting the burger I'd devoured for lunch. I discovered that New York is a much, much drunker city than I'd ever imagined. At any time of the day, any day of the week, I could join men in suits to stagger around, purple-toothed and a little buzzed, sampling the newest wines. I took the advice of a young somm who'd also learned to taste on a budget and used the tastings to figure out the distinct flavor profile of the classic grape varieties. One week, I drank nothing but Sauvignon Blanc. The next week would be exclusively Riesling, then Tempranillo, and so on. I was trying to wrap my tongue around each one's character, Merlot's plumminess, say, or Pinot Noir's cherryness, and understand how that grape changed as it crossed climates and countries. Every Thursday, I'd stumble back over to the restaurant where I worked for yet another round of tastings. For 2.5 hours, sales reps stopped by with suitcases full of bottles. I tried them all, but that still wasn't enough drinking. To hone my flavor sensing skills, I needed to learn to blind taste. In other words, to figure out through taste and smell alone the year wine was made, from what grapes, and in what corner of the planet. So far, I'd weaseled my way into 2 blind tasting groups. Fridays, I met with beginners. Wednesdays, I joined advanced sommeliers. They like to taste early in the day, believing their senses to be more alert in the morning than after a day of stimulation. So, at 10 a.m. every Wednesday, we'd show up to a somm's apartment in Queens, lugging bottles hidden under crumpled aluminum foil or tucked into knee socks. In between my liquid training, I was sniffing at quinces, munching a mix of apple species, and seeing how long I could smell herbs at my local Fairway supermarket before arousing the suspicions of the security guard. Master sommeliers had advised me to develop my sense memory, to implant the impression of animals, vegetables, and minerals in my mind so deeply I'd be able to recognize these odors in a wine. The advice kept coming. Taste all different types of citruses. Try the peel, the pith, the juice. Someone else recommended that I add a little dirt to my diet. Lick rocks when you're around outside, he said. I lick rocks all the time, he assured me. What kind of rocks? I asked. Any rocks that I haven't licked before, he answered. It's fun to taste the difference between red slate and blue slate. My husband came home early from work one evening and caught me gumming gravel. He was quiet for a long time before he gave me the sanest advice yet. Have you thought about asking for your old job back?
Bianca Bosker is the author of Cork Dork, and she left us with a list of the books that pointed her way towards wine dorkdom. Find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, The Science of Salmon, and David Lee on his new book, Notes on a Banana. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Our friend and contributor David Lee has had a rich, award-winning career in culinary writing, but it turns out he wasn't always excited about food. For him, food has also long been tied up with his struggles with his weight, complicated family life, sexuality, and mental illness, until he realized that feeding and being fed by his partner could bring him back to his roots. Our contributor Shauna Seaver talked with David about his revealing new book, Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression.
Hello, David Leet.
Hello, Shauna.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Now, like a lot of people, I knew of your work initially from the food world. And so when I first picked up this book, I think maybe I was expecting more of a traditional food memoir. But this is not that. No, there are so many more themes intertwined. Now, you begin the book talking about your early childhood memories growing up in Fall River, Massachusetts, as part of a big Portuguese family. Can you tell us a little about the family dynamic and the role that food played in your family?
Sure. I was born in 1960, so this was the 60s, and it was in one house. We called it a tenement. A tenement back then was a three-story house that was three apartments, and we had a nice big yard, and there was a vegetable garden in back. And it was my mother, my father, myself on the second floor, and my godmother, my godfather, and my cousin Barry on the first floor in the front. And the first floor in back was my grandmother and my grandfather. And there were tons of cousins and all these relations that would always come over. So there was always very kind of raucous meals that we would have. And, of course, there was tons and tons of Portuguese food being served. There was codfish and rice and sausages and all different foods that we had. But for me, from a very early age, I didn't want to eat Portuguese food. I didn't see anything about Portuguese people on television. I didn't see us being represented anywhere. So I internalized this notion of Portuguese as sort of being bad and Portuguese as not being American. So all I wanted growing up was I just wanted American food. I wanted Betty Crocker cakes with Betty Crocker frosting and anything you saw on television, Spam, Velveeta. Those are the things that I desperately wanted. So I turned my nose up at a lot of foods when I was younger.
Now, you do mention that in the book and calling it wanting to be American by consumption. And you mentioned some of these foods that gave you that feeling growing up. But why do you feel it was so important to you to separate yourself from your heritage in this way through food?
When I was very young, there was, I don't understand why, but there seemed to be a lot of prejudice against the Portuguese coming over. And I don't understand why, because there were so many Portuguese living there. Maybe the Portuguese were the newest people and on the lowest rung, and therefore they were being picked on. But they would say really horrible things like Portuguese. Like a Portuguese is a really, to me, a very insulting phrase, or pork chop. And so I saw the venom with which these invectives were spewed out at my father and at my mother and at our family and other families too that are Portuguese. And so I just internalized that there was something wrong with us. And up to that point, I didn't know anything but Portuguese. And so that was like the first inkling that there was something different about us. And that embarrassed me.
Later on in the book, we learn about your challenges with mental illness for pretty much your entire life.
Yeah.
And your struggles with your sexuality for a number of years, your battles with weight and self-image. And through it all, it seems that food was both your savior and a source of great anxiety for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Food played many different roles. In the beginning, it was my nemesis. I wanted to get away from it. I wanted, like I said, all this American food that I saw on television. And when some of the mental illness started showing its face, at 11, 12 years old, I started having panic attacks. And food was very comforting. And I would eat Portuguese food, American food, anything that was put on the table because it was comfort for me. And then I went through a period where I lost a lot of weight and I would not eat. So it became the enemy again. And it was very difficult to embrace food. And then I met the one who in the book everyone now finds out is Alan. And he kind of turned my head around about food. And then I slowly began eating. And then I slowly began eating more and more. And I got into the food world and ate more and more and more. And so I became the 180-degree opposite of what I was when I met Alan and became very overweight, which is what I'm struggling with now.
And food does play quite a role in your relationship, although I found it very interesting that his food experience with his family growing up was very mm-hmm. different from yours.
Yeah. His table, when he sat down with his stepfather and his mother, was always fraught with a lot of emotion. There was a lot of anger. His stepfather was a very difficult person. And I didn't know this for quite a while. And then he revealed that to me. And I was very surprised because he didn't seem to be scarred by that, as a lot of people would. But what came out of that, because he was always trying to duck out of the table. So as soon as he was done, he would just like slink away so he wouldn't be seen by his stepfather. What that did was cause him to become a diner. He is a diner. And I come from a family of eaters. We eat. We are raucous. We are loud. We eat. Alan comes along, and very early on, I realized we had to dine. He had to light candles. He had to play music. It had to be china on the table. I couldn't have the cereal box in front of me and read the back of it like I did when I was a kid. It had to be poured into the bowl. Milk had to be poured in, and we sat and we talked. And when we were done, he would push away. And he would expect us to continue talking. And I'm like, what? We're going to sit at the table and continue talking? I have things to do. I have a life. But that's not how he wanted his life to be, based upon what his childhood was. So we had a lot of grappling of this diner versus eater for the early parts of our relationship.
Now, there's a very powerful scene in the book where you talk about Alan making a certain cake for you that really yes. unearths some strong memories.
Yes. He decided to make, it was, I believe, a pineapple upside down cake. And he said, hey, do you want to lick the bowl? And when I took a swipe of the batter and I tasted it, there was this Proustian moment that hurtled me back to my childhood. And the smell of the butter and the smell of the flour all mixed together was so familiar, but I had never really baked and he had never baked for me before. So it wasn't something in our relationship. And I called my mom and I said, Ma, did you ever bake? And I knew the answer. And she's like, come on, Banana, you know that I don't bake. And she says, but Vovó did. Vovó's grandmother in Portuguese. She said, Vovó did. And I'm like, she did? She goes, don't you remember? She used to pull up the chair to the stove and you would stand on the chair and you would cook and bake together. And these memories that I had forgotten just came flooding back to me. And a door was pried open to my past. And all of that pushing down my Portuguese heritage, pushing down anything that had to do with my family and food, just popped open with that smell and that taste of that cake batter. And I was enrolled in a baking class, I think, 2 weeks later.
And it was such a small thing that really changed the course of your life, this waking up to realizing that you had positive food memories. And at that point in the book, it really does start to almost have kind of a domino effect, I felt, when I was reading it. And you take this trip to Portugal with the mm-hmm. one who has you go to your grandmother's house or the house where your grandmother used to live.
My family, both sides of my family, is from the island of San Miguel in the Azores, which are 9 islands about 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal. And we had gone there to San Miguel, to the town of Maia, which is where my father's family is from. And I had heard about this house since I was a kid. Dirt floors, rough stone walls, a wall oven, the pigsty in the back. And then beyond that was the outhouse where the chickens would peck your butt when you did your business. Very rustic, very rural. And so I wanted to see the house. And it was at that point owned by a cousin of my grandfather. So we went, knocked on the door, unannounced. And I said in Portuguese, I'm David Leite, the son of Emmanuel and Elvira Leite. And the woman looked at me, and then there was this, David. And she like hugs me, and she just took my head and like brought it all the way down to her bosom. And she's about 4 feet tall, so I was like bent way over. And she had us come in, but when I walked in, it was a very different house. It was this beautiful flooring, and there was this huge screen television. And in the kitchen, it was all yellow appliances. It was just a modern kitchen. And this woman, Elvira, had 2 daughters who spoke English, and I said, is the oven still there, the wall oven? And I had heard about stories of how my grandmother, Leite, Vovó Leite, would cook in there. And also that's where they got some of their heat. And I'd heard all these stories. And so Elvira said, I sing. And she asked Alan and me to move the stove forward and then move this big metal plate behind the stove away, and there was the stove. There was the brick oven, the wall oven, and it was an astounding moment for me because I connected with my family in a way that I had never did before. And I say that if roots could have come out of my feet and burrowed their way into the volcanic soil of that island, they would have, because I finally felt that I was where I belonged. And it was an extraordinarily powerful moment for me.
Well, I, for one, am so glad that this moment happened, because that led you to your food writing career, which then led you to writing this book, which mm-hmm. is really extraordinary. And I love talking with you about it. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having me.
David Leet's new book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. Shauna Seaver's latest book is Real Sweet. You can find David's recipe for one of his family favorites, Azorian kale and bean soup, at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at this week's video. It's a conversation about returning to the family farm with Nikiko Masumoto. She's a young peach farmer in the Central Valley of California, and she's just incredibly smart and inspiring. It's a thoughtful conversation about family roots and desires and loyalties, and it's at splendidtable.org. America's favorite fish is salmon. And salmon is pretty amazing, not just when it's food, I mean, like when it's alive. Look at this. When wild salmon are born, they're born in freshwater. But then they swim out to the sea and they spend most of their lives there. Then they return to the very same water they were born in to lay their eggs and then die and fertilize the ecosystem. Now, most of the salmon we eat is farmed, and so it doesn't live that same active lifestyle, I guess you can call it. And our managing producer, Sally Swift, wondered if that made a difference in how we should cook wild or farm salmon. So she talked to Dan Souza, executive editor of Cook Science.
Hey, Dan, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
So I have a question about salmon that occurred to me last week when I was cooking up some game birds that a friend had given me and realizing how different they are than regular old farmed birds. And then I started thinking, is wild salmon different from farmed salmon?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and you've made a really nice comparison there to game birds and maybe chicken that you normally be cooking at home. And there's actually a big difference between wild salmon and farm-raised salmon. I know we look at them as being the same thing, but there's a big difference, and it really all comes down to lifestyle. So farm-raised salmon, they lead a very sedentary life. They're in a small cage usually or a small tank, and they are fed a lot so that they grow quickly. And that kind of lifestyle leads to two different things. One is muscles that aren't as well developed. So the collagen in farm-raised salmon has less chemical crosslinks. It's less structured than it is in wild salmon. And they also have more fat. The fattiest farm-raised salmon has about 4 times more fat than the leanest wild species.
Wow, that is crazy.
Yeah, so it's a really big difference. And when it comes time to cook them, that has a huge impact. You know, if you cook a really fatty steak, it stays juicy even if you overcook it by a little mm-hmm. bit. So when we cook wild salmon, we find that when it's cooked to 125 degrees, which is our preferred temperature for most fish and for farm-raised salmon, it tastes a little dry. And that's because it has less fat and the muscle fibers are already a little bit firmer. So we did a test in the kitchen where we cooked wild and farm-raised salmon to 2 different internal temperatures, 120 degrees and 125 mm-hmm. degrees. So we use a digital instant read thermometer, just as we would when cooking steak. And we had people try both samples at both temperatures. And every single person preferred the farm-raised salmon cooked to the higher temperature, 125 mm-hmm. degrees. We tried 5 different wild species, and everyone preferred them cooked to 120 degrees, so 5 degrees less.
You know, with the prices of wild salmon, it sure makes sense to know how to cook it correctly. Can you give me just a really quick primer on some of the names of wild salmon? Because I think sometimes we don't realize what's wild and what is farmed.
Absolutely. So when you're at the store, you'll see farm-raised Atlantic salmon should always be labeled as farm-raised. But if you see Atlantic, it has to be farm-raised. It's illegal to catch wild salmon from the Atlantic Ocean. So everything else is going to be your wild species. So you have Chinook, also known as king salmon. There's coho, which is also known as silver. You also have sockeye salmon, which is very common, has a very, very dark flesh. And some of the less common ones that are often used in canned salmon are pink and chum, which you probably won't see as much. Mm-hmm. The king or coho salmon is kind of considered the king of wild salmon. So it'll have more fat than the other species. It's a much bigger fish, and it's kind of a darling of chefs. People really like that one.
So, Dan, do you have a salmon recipe you go to all the time that you love?
Yes. At the Test Kitchen, we have a ton of really great salmon recipes. One that I really love is a miso marinated salmon. We make a mixture of miso, sake, mirin, and sugar. We coat some skin on salmon fillets with that. And we let them sit for a fairly long time, at least 6 hours and up to overnight. And what happens during that time is we actually get a lot of the moisture, the kind of the surface moisture of the fish comes out. The flesh firms up a little bit in a nice way. And we get tons of great flavor from the miso, a lot of savoriness and some sweetness. And then it's a really simple dish. We basically preheat the broiler and it goes underneath. And the sugar in the miso and the protein browns really nicely. So you get this kind of mahogany exterior. And the inside of the fish is really silky. Tons of flavor and a really simple recipe.
Gorgeous. Sounds great. Hey, Dan, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Dan Souza is executive editor of Cook Science at America's Test Kitchen. You can find his video for the science of salmon and their recipe for miso marinated salmon at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to talk to you. And later, a conversation with the duo from the podcast Spilled Milk about raising kids to be adventurous eaters. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam. All right, now I get to talk to you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. So we have Matt calling. Matt, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina.
Right on. What do you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about asparagus. It's asparagus season here in North Carolina, and I'm sure most places. And my go-to has always been just crank the oven up as hot as it can go, toss the asparagus mm-hmm. with some olive oil and salt, and roast it really high, which I absolutely love. I think it's, you know, kind of the truest form of asparagus. But I'm looking for new inspiration.
Yeah. New, less true forms of asparagus? New, more adulterated forms of asparagus?
Yes, yeah. Let's mess with it just a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, I love asparagus. And yeah, I think what you have is totally right on. I love a really good high-heat roast. I think that's such a great thing to do. But yeah, I think it's one of those things, especially if you're really into like asparagus season and you want to eat it in the season, then you kind of overload on it. So I totally feel you. You know, I think it's one of those things when you have a vegetable that's delicious raw and it's delicious very cooked, then you're kind of in like a great zone because you kind of know anywhere in between it's going to be good.
Yeah.
So maybe we can start from the raw and go up to the cooked again. So raw asparagus is great in salad. It has that, you know, that sort of grassy flavor. It's so crisp and so pure. When I make asparagus salads, I love to just peel them. Like just take a regular vegetable peeler, and if you have a big thick asparagus, maybe you want to get rid of the first few swipes, you know, when you get that sort of thick skin off, and then you just kind of run the peeler across the whole thing, and you end up with these essentially like asparagus fettuccine looking guys.
Okay,
and they're super tender.
You know, I've seen that, and I got to be honest, I guess I just got lazy and didn't want to peel it, but you're kind of inspiring me to put the effort in there.
It's a quick process. Zip, 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 zip. So when you have a nice pile of those peels, I love to add something tart, something acidic, something fatty. Like you can do a vinaigrette. I like it actually with a Caesar salad.
Oh, wow.
I like something a little bit spicy with it. So maybe some arugula with it, or maybe some finely cut radishes to get a little bit of bite. I love something crunchy, some toasted almonds or walnuts, or actually, you know what sounds really great to me is peanuts.
Oh, interesting.
I don't see that as a combination very often, but right now in my head, I'm tasting like roasted peanuts with asparagus, and that sounds really good.
Yeah, you get that nuttiness, the saltiness, everything in there.
Yeah, totally. So you can make a salad, you know, maybe some like nice buttermilk dressing or a vinaigrette, or just go simple, like lemon, olive oil, maybe some shaved Parmesan. A few years ago, Melissa Clark wrote a column. She's a recipe writer for the New York Times, and she contributes to our show a lot. And she wrote a column about braising asparagus in butter, which, I mean,
oh my God,
automatic win, right? Yeah, so you like you kind of melt like a sort of irresponsible amount of butter in like a tall-sided saute pan. You just kind of melt the butter. It doesn't have to be very hot. You're not really trying to fry it. And then you just lay in the stalks in one layer, salt them,
okay,
and just kind of let them slowly cook until they're nice and tender. They might lose that nice bright green color.
Mm-hmm.
Up to you if you want to take them out when they're still a little crispy and do that. But she did it in a way where I remember the asparagus getting really quite soft. So it's starting to lose that green color a little bit, starting to get a tiny bit over into like the army green territory. But what it does is it really makes the asparagus super silky and tender. And then you take it out, you pat it dry with a paper towel if you want, if you don't want that much butter on it. And it's just so delicious and luxurious, really.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I mean, you had me a braised in butter.
It just sounds good, right? Like, that just sounds like a universal good idea. And actually, I remember making this too, and the first time I made it, I was like, oh, now you have this whole pot of butter. I mean, often when you have like butter braised things, you kind of think like, oh, I don't want to waste all that butter. But mm-hmm. the butter actually ends up taking on a lot of asparagus flavor, and you have this sort of flavored asparagus butter, which is kind of fun to play with on its own, letting that re-harden and maybe spreading that on toast or using that to cook other things in. It was kind of a cool thing to play with.
Awesome.
I mean, I got more for you if you need it, man. Like,
those are, you know, this time of year when asparagus comes around, every time I see it at the market, I just buy it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, overdose on asparagus between, you know, now and in the next few weeks before they go away.
Yeah.
And then I wait again for it to come back next year. So it's kind of my special spring treat. So
right on, man. Well, enjoy your season.
Thank you, Francis.
Hey, thanks for calling.
No problem.
We have Paige calling in right now. Hey, Paige, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm great, thanks.
Oh, great. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Vancouver.
Oh, I love Vancouver. It's so gorgeous.
It is.
Oh, my.
Anyways, I'm calling. I recently came, just returned from a vacation to Egypt. And while I was there, I went to like a real spice market, not a tourist one. And I picked up a variety of different blends and za'atars and different curries and all kinds of stuff. But I picked up some really good, some like real saffron and quite a bit of it because it was such a good deal. But I actually don't really have any ideas on what to put saffron in. I haven't, it's usually such a like a luxury spice item that I just have usually a couple threads, not like I have like 100 grams of it.
Wait, you time out. Hold on. You have 100 grams of saffron?
Yeah, I have a lot.
That's like a quarter pound of saffron. Like, what's the street value of a quarter pound of saffron?
Honestly, like it was, I was told to go there that this is a really good place to get saffron. And I would say that in U.S. dollars, like it was around $30 or $40 maybe.
Oh, my God.
Like I was
God.
Told, like, that's... this is a good place to get saffron. So I was like, okay, I'll get lots.
What you should do is not cook with it and just go on the street and sell it in little bags. That's what I think you should do. Just don't get pulled over. Don't look suspicious. You'll be fine. But just like, hey, saffron, I got saffron. But that's amazing. You know, saffron is a flavor that is so revered and respected and sort of like legendary. You know, it's one of these things, or like you said, it's an extraordinary luxury ingredient, often extremely expensive. And it's actually a flavor that to me is so distinct. You know, I've been thinking for so many years about how to describe the flavor of saffron. And finally, one day it hit me. The flavor of saffron to me is exactly the same as what the air smells like after fireworks. I think of it as a little bit smoky and a little bit metallic, but floral. And you know, it's also like the air after a fireworks show. Like everyone's feeling kind of high and kind of good and like everything's all right. I actually do associate all those things with the flavor of saffron. So if you're thinking about different flavors to pair it with, often like sweet spices and nuts are really, really lovely. Like anise and saffron is really nice.
Okay.
I love pistachios and saffron, which is certainly super mm-hmm. traditional. If I have that much of it, I would think about making an ice cream with it.
Okay.
Yeah, you make like a ice cream base, you know, your favorite recipe, whatever it is. And when the base is still warm, I would throw in a few pinches of it and let it steep for a few minutes directly in the base. And I would think of using that ice cream and topping it with pistachios, or I can imagine like cocoa nibs being really beautiful with it, like a little bit of that nutty, buttery, sort of bitter edge. But I have a friend, one of my best friends in the world. He has a sandwich shop in Boston. It's called Cuddy's. And he makes all these great sandwiches. He's like famous for his roast beef sandwich and all this other stuff. But like, there's just one secret hero on his menu. It's one of my favorites. And it's super simple. He just sautés Swiss chard until it's really nice and tender. And he sauces it with a mixture of saffron-infused yogurt and a little bit of mayonnaise. And that combination of the Swiss chard and saffron, and I imagine almost any sautéed green with a little bit of saffron and yogurt, is just fantastic.
Very good.
Yeah, it brings that sort of like metallic, sort of smoky, kind of floral edge to this otherwise earthy, a little bit bitter green. And it's just such a cool combination. Yeah, so play around with it.
I know. The guy at the spice bar, he's like, just put in everything. I'm like, well, I certainly have enough.
Yeah, just play around with it and take notes.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have fun. I'm jealous.
Okay.
And remember, you can call us anytime, 1-800-537-5252, and leave us a message with your question. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us, contact@splendidtable.org. So the last time I talked about my baby daughter on this show, she was breaking my heart and like spitting out the beautiful cauliflower puree I made her. But in the months since, she's turned into a totally different eater. She's mowing down broccoli, salmon collars, pigtails. She even, I swear to God, voluntarily ate 2 pieces of bitter melon the other day. So I think I'm pretty set. Like, I can go cross off raise a good eater. But then I heard that lots of kids start out eating everything and then they change. And now I'm feeling really anxious. So I really want to talk to two wise friends who have some experience in the matter. Matthew Amster Burton wrote a book called Hungry Monkey about trying to raise his baby daughter, who's now 13, as an adventurous eater. And his co-host on the podcast Spilled Milk is Molly Weisenberg, who has a young daughter of her own. Molly, Matthew, thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having us.
Hello.
Okay, so is it true that my dear darling sweetheart baby is going to stop eating broccoli rabe and fish cheeks and I'm going to resent her for it?
Well, it might be true. I mean, that's the bad news. You know, everything you've done right so far is going to buy you absolutely nothing in about a year or so when, you know, it's not just that she starts having opinions of her own. It's that she's going to get less hungry. You know, a baby is just like, you know, doubling in size every couple of months practically. And then when they hit 2, it slows down a lot and they need to eat a lot less. And that freaks parents out.
Well, and I mean, the other thing is that, you know, she's going to start figuring out that she has lots of opinions. And I don't know, there's a mixed blessing in there, don't you think, Matthew? I mean, like, my kid, pretty much, my daughter's 4. And I think if she were left to her own devices, she would eat all different forms of meat all day long, supplemented with some fruit. And that's, I don't know, I think it's kind of cool to see that develop. But it is frustrating at times.
Your daughter's paleo.
Basically. Yeah, my tried and true method for eating happily with my child is to pretend that I absolutely don't care whether she eats what's in front of her or not.
That's fascinating because I, when, you know, if there's a day, and there are these days where, you know, I try to feed my dog and she's just kind of not into it, I start to panic. It's irrational. I know it's irrational, but I actually do start to feel like, oh my God, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah, and I mean, aside from the nutritional part, you know, as food people, we are like programmed to feel personally offended when someone doesn't like the food that we made, right? And when it's this person that you love and just want to share everything with them, and they're like, "Nah, I don't like this," I would feel crushed. And like, I knew that if I showed it, you know, the light would go off in the little brain, and be like, "Okay, you know, this is my lever of control over Dad, and I am going to use it every day for the rest of my life." And I mean, she has plenty of levers of control over me that she does use, but I wanted to try and sort of nip that one as much as possible. And sometimes I succeeded, and sometimes not.
So stone face, poker face.
Yeah, and I did not by any means originate this idea. I got it from Ellen Satter's book, Child of Mine, which is a great book about feeding infants to teenagers, basically. And I recommend it, but also you can be boiled down to kind of provide good food and then don't worry about whether and how much they eat at any given meal.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I grew up, I think, in a pretty like typical American household where like I had to have milk every night with dinner and I was supposed to take a like no thank you helping of everything, even if I didn't want it. And, you know, it's a tricky balance to figure out how to help your child taste all the things you want them to taste while also acting like you absolutely have no stake in the game and you're just putting the food in front of them and they get to choose what they eat. And I would also say that all three of us are raising daughters.
Yep.
And I also think that this is kind of like a thing about like, I want my daughter to know when she's hungry and know when she's full and know what she wants. Like, it's her body. She's in charge of it. It's kind of a feminist issue.
Yeah. That's super, super interesting. And it's really a matter of the world is full of messages, particularly for young girls and women, mm-hmm. about eating and what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat and how it's going to affect your body and how you're going to look and how people are going to judge you and how like all that stuff totally, totally is going to be bombarding them. You know, but there's still this part of me. It's always like, I want you to be a great eater. I want her to be super adventurous. But I don't know. Is that
yeah.
like... Does it matter? Am I just trying to live vicariously through her? Like, why does it matter
well,
so much to us?
Whether it matters or not, the way she eats at age 1 or 2 or 3 or 8 is not going to resemble that much the way she eats when she's 25, probably. Because I remember for me, like, I was a real picky eater when I was a kid. And then I got to college and I saw, okay, there are all these different foods available at the dining hall. And a lot of the people around me are not picky eaters. And it's going to be, you know, I felt peer pressure. And, you know, at that moment, I'm like, okay, I'm going to hit the salad bar and try some of these things that I see other people trying. And, they were good. Your kid's diet is not set magically at age 3 and is going to last the rest of their life. It continues to evolve. And, you know, we focus on these times when kids are really, really picky because they're expressing their opinions and they're not very hungry and think, okay, we have to solve this problem right now or my kid is going to be in trouble. And it just doesn't work that way.
And I think the tricky thing is, too, you know, I mean, we're all right. We're all perfect parents before we have kids. Of course.
Yes.
Of course. And so I think for those of us who are really into food and love cooking and love eating, like we want the world to see our child as an adventurous eater.
Yeah.
Like we don't want to be the parent that maybe we used to look at who was letting their kid eat whatever. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know. I feel like my relationship with my daughter around food is really fun and harmonious most of the time. And we're going to learn about food that we eat because it fuels our body and food that we eat because it's fun. And there's time and there's space for everything.
All right. So I guess it's learn to let go and let there be hope. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thank you, Francis.
Thanks for having us.
Molly Weisenberg and Matthew Amster Burton are the creators of the podcast Spilled Milk. They left us a recipe for braised escarole with beans that Molly swears that her daughter eats, which, I mean, like, I didn't lay eyes on my first piece of escarole until I was 25, so right on, Molly. Anyway, you can find that recipe at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for the week. It was so great to have you with us, and Lynn will be back next week with a great story about a Vietnamese pop star who now runs a sandwich shop in California. Don't miss it. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Dr. Maya Angelou. She wrote, "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And hey, remember, you can always head to splendidtable.org for all of your food and eating needs. Get registered for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, to help you get real meals on your table midweek. If you want to take the show with you wherever you go, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like it, please leave us a review on iTunes. It really helps us out. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. She actually makes it all happen. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb. And this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.